The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
What say you, Richard Pellet Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them. Okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
The indictments of the defendant Alec Murdoch for the murders of his wife Maggie and his son Paul, the state of South Carolina rests.
Welcome to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdoch murders, money, and mystery. I'm Ann Emerson. I'm joined by our exclusive legal analyst, Charlie Condon. He is also the South Carolina's former attorney general, as well as our executive producer, Drew Tripp. And Max Harrison, he's running the boards. He's back there. He's running the production. And if you have any questions, he's fielding them for us, and we'll certainly try to get to them. We're going to be on all streaming channels, right? We've got Facebook. We've got YouTube. We're on TikTok right now, so you can watch us live streaming.
Yeah, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, and abcnews4.com.
Perfect. So tonight we need to probably play a clip pretty soon, but I just wanted to see if there was anything I was missing before we did that. The state has rested its case against Alec Murdoch. Mm-hmm. We now have the opportunity to hear the defense. Before we go there, I just really love how Charlie explained it earlier about how, you know, I was going back and forth looking at the story that we were working on at 6 p.m. And I think it's very important for everybody listening to this right now to understand what the objective is for the state and the defense. Not in a detailed way, but just the way you explained it to me when we were talking about what I was writing in my 6 p.m.
In terms of burden
just
of proof.
The burden of proof. If we could just kind of clarify.
Yeah, I think it's a good, actually it's a good civic lesson. I hope not to be too teachy here or pedantic, but in this country, which I think is the bulwark of our freedoms, that the government or the state cannot lock you up unless 12 jurors have a unanimous verdict agree on a guilty verdict. And before they even get there, though, the state of South Carolina, the government, has the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. And the burden is always on the state of South Carolina. The defense has no obligation to testify or to put any evidence up. And so if the state doesn't meet its burden, then the jurors are obligated to find someone not guilty. Now, before we get there, and Judge Newman, under our procedure, state procedure, the defense did move. It's not the high standard. It's a Rule 19 motion for a directed verdict if there wasn't competent or good evidence to prove the indictment. The judge has the ability to take the case away from the jury and dismiss it. I don't think anyone ever really thought that was a realistic possibility, but Attorney Griffin gave it his best shot. He argued passionately, and we'll talk about this, but Prosecutor Waters argued in opposition quite well, and Judge Newman agreed with the state, so we move on.
Well, so here is what Prosecutor Creighton Waters gave as his, I guess, synopsis of the case, the summary of his case against
mm-hmm.
Alec Murdoch.
Yeah, his arguments against the directed verdict, and he laid it out, I thought, quite eloquently.
So bear with us. It's just a couple of minutes, but it's an amazing way for everyone to sort of wrap their heads around what the state was trying to accomplish here.
There's been ample evidence of motive evidence presented in this particular case. The years of embezzlement and theft and the exposure, very significant exposure that the defendant was facing as June the 7th approached, which includes the loss of a job, the loss of a career, the loss of his bar license, the loss of years of wealth, the potential to lose everything in his own words. You've heard evidence about a confrontation June 7th on those matters that very day, as well as the boat hearing that was upcoming. And the effects that that would have. Also heard extensive evidence of the defendant's financial condition on that day as it moved forward. Also evidence, Your Honor, of his ongoing narcotics addiction and how those particular things were relevant to what was going on as it related to the victims. There's been evidence, and again, as Your Honor is aware, the evidence must be taken in the light most favorable to the state, that family weapons were used to murder Maggie and Paul.
Well, there you go.
Wow.
That's a lot. You know, and basically I wanted you to just hear that because the jury did not hear that, just to be clear, that, right?
Correct.
That was just the state arguing why they mustn't dismiss, why the judge mustn't dismiss this case, mm-hmm. and why this must go forward. And I remember the judge said, yes, and the reason I think this needs to go forward is I feel like the state has presented not just circumstantial, but true physical evidence of this case. So it was just a fascinating moment for us to all hear, of course, because it was, we're always looking for a good summation of what's going on in the case at any given time.
Yeah, and that was a great summation, but equally importantly, and in a way eloquently, was the timeline, as they called it. And we've talked about this. I don't really think it's a timeline per se. I look at it more as a distillation of the electronic evidence that the state had. I had looked at it sort of like pieces of a puzzle that were throughout the courtroom floor, so to speak. And you couldn't quite, I mean, you got the outline maybe, but you couldn't quite put it together. And this SLED agent, Rudowski, I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, right. His demeanor and the way he presented it, I thought was just so effective. And he went through it really line by line, page by page, took several hours, but very, very powerful in my view.
Yeah, he was a very strong witness for the state. And I think this was a much needed, again, to Ann's point, we wanted to play that soundbite of Creighton Waters mm-hmm. just because we know, from our perspective, and we know you all at home listening, watching, have been struggling a little bit with this too, is to keep it all together and try and make sense of everything you're hearing, because we've heard some things day one, day three, mm-hmm. day 10, and we're now on day 20, and it hasn't all been tied back together and put into perspective, and it's hard to keep up with. And that was why we wanted to play Creighton Waters, because it was very succinct, very powerful. But on the same, while the jury didn't hear that, what they did hear is this Agent Rudowski from SLED. And again, he really got it all to make sense, at least in my estimation, listening to him, everything was neatly packaged. Everything flowed sequentially. It was much easier to follow than anything that's happened so far. And it's the moment we've all been waiting for, the moment we've been demanding, when are they going to tie this all together and show us exactly how this all fits, how the puzzle goes together? I still think from a perspective of this being a circumstantial evidence case, there are some things that we may never get answered and haven't been answered. I can get
like
into those.
What?
You want me to get into them now?
Sure.
For me, this biggest leap of logic and head scratcher, if you will, mm-hmm. is the lone gunman theory. Just because I don't think the state, and I don't think they can, I don't believe the state ever definitively put together how Alec accomplished it. If Alec is the gunman, how he did it, how he accomplished it. And bear with me on my reasoning here. Two guns, he would have had to have them either stashed down there. And when did he do that? Because I don't think that's spelled out in this timeline we got today, when he would have had the opportunity to go down there and do that. If not stashed down there, he had them readily available somehow. And he would have had, in my estimation, you take into account the context. Okay, both Maggie and Paul, their initial gunshot wounds were said to be extreme close range. They were intimately close, within 5 feet, because they had the stippling on the first gunshot wounds that they indicating that their bodies were within 3 to 4 feet of the end of that gun barrel. So how does a lone gunman get that close to two people without one fleeing and running away from them? There's a lot of holes in there that you got to fill in to make it make sense. Okay, maybe
I think one, that's really interesting.
Maybe one came running when they heard the gunshots and ran right into a trap, or maybe it was, as Creighton Waters kind of, I think he even alluded to this in his opening statement, it was just immediate where he had them, and out of nowhere he surprised them. He grabbed one gunshot, picked up the other one. But how did he accomplish that? Again, that gives, where's the gun
stash? I'll tell you how.
Okay.
Here's how he did it. And I bet we hear this from Creighton Waters. Alec Murdoch trades in trust. Everyone trusted him. So he's down there with his family. It's a peaceful evening. And former prosecutor being as he is, he knows that he needs to think through how to not have him as a suspect, because the person who calls 911 is always a suspect. So you stash the rifles. You crouch down, or kneel, as you say. Paul would be, right? You'd have to agree that would be easy for him to accomplish without any suspicion whatsoever. It's a son in there. He puts these two loads in, which is quite odd. Gets steel shot to make it a bit odder. And mind you, he had these weapons stashed already. So he pulls up the shotgun, and we went through with with Dr. Kinsey on how that was done. The low shot, and then the second shot. Now, one would think in the abstract that, gosh, then Maggie would run away. But remember, it's her beloved husband there. She's a bit far away.
Right.
And she, you know, boom, boom, right? I think he laid up brilliantly.
In the opening statement, that's what he was doing. He said, pow, pow.
Happened very quickly. And then Maggie might come to investigate, or is not fearful of her husband, because there's no way the husband's going to kill the son, right? And so he then approaches her with a rifle, and she might be thinking, well, he's here to defend me, for that matter. And so she approaches, and there you have it. I think that's a plausible explanation for the two-shooter theory, but I think where the state would go with this, if I were prosecuting, I wouldn't particularly worry about, I'd have that as a possible explanation, but I would harp on what my evidence is. And the evidence is so, that timeline, or distillation of the evidence thus far, maybe this, the defense can challenge it, but I don't see any way, and Judge Newman used the word circumstantial and direct, that this electronic evidence to me is getting to be so intense and so weaves together so much with the physical evidence, and almost is becoming direct to me. It's almost like you're there. But well, for your question, I think that's a good question.
And, you know, where I can jump into is because sort of my job today was to kind of go into that timeline a little bit. Mm-hmm. And some of the things that I noticed that I felt like we hadn't heard before, I thought that was interesting as far as things that were kind of some of these questions, not all the questions. Obviously, we still have questions about how this is all going to pan out. But one of the things was he made it very clear in this timeline that 844 was when we understand from several witnesses that they believe Alec's voice was on a video taken by Paul at the kennel at 844. Mm-hmm. And then very clearly he states, because we have that cell phone data, that those phones locked. Maggie and Paul's phones basically locked, went dark, however you want to say it, like they weren't answering them. At 8:49. So all of a sudden, our timeline just got very tight, very quick. A couple of other things that I noticed as well was when he went to go see his mom at Alameda. Remember, we're dealing with data across the board. So that, let's think at 9:02 to 9:06. So 8:49, those phones go dark. 9:02 to 9:06. They are able to see because Apple has, you know, we all watch our steps, see how many steps we've done for the day. All of a sudden, he takes this extraordinary amount of steps in a short period of time. And from my calculations, it was about three times faster than he had been traveling at any other time during the day. from 9:02 to 9:06. He gets in the car at 9:06. He goes to Alameda. We hear about this. And as he's driving about 45 miles an hour. Well, guess whose phone was also going or traveling, from what I understand, about 45 miles an hour, was Maggie's. Was that, did you get that?
I thought the phone might have been locked and therefore wasn't tracking. But what I did think was very telling, and I'm not saying you aren't correct, but I remember it differently. But what I do remember very telling is the speed slowed up sufficient for him to throw the phone out, which was much slower than any speed on that road to Alameda. He then sped up after that. So, again, if he's not totally involved with these murders, he's got to be one of the most unluckiest persons in the history of humanity, right? Because here he is slowing down where the phone is found. Well, and it just keeps going on. And the 20-minute timeline, right, at Alameda, that it just goes on. I think there are 100 circumstances that convict him.
I think I got to disagree with both of you. I think you both aren't on the mark with either of those things. I don't think we ever got it that her phone was moving at that speed, unless it's buried in this long timeline that Sled sent out.
No, I'm with you on that. I don't think it did.
I agree with faster phone was going, but also Charlie, I don't think it was that his vehicle slowed down. It was more so that it just accelerated very, very slowly.
He stayed at 40. Otherwise, it was 45.
Yeah, he didn't get up to speed. He stayed in the 40 range for up to like a minute and a half after he pulled out of the driveway.
Slow in terms of what he could have been doing. And then he then sped up, right? It got up to like, was it 70?
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be hard, I think, to throw a phone out at 70 and a bit easier at the lower speed. Right when, I mean, it was within the... You know the road better than I do. In fact, I don't think I've ever been on it. But if you turn on there, wouldn't you be going quick, fast, very quickly versus the...
You could. You could. It's...
wouldn't you? You'd go speed limit at least, wouldn't you? I think the state thinks that's probative of... And useful for their position.
But, well, let me tell myself here. If there are any children listening, I don't know why there would be any children or teenagers or anyone who might...
Oh, on TikTok. No, you're right. No one's listening that's a teenager on TikTok.
I don't... I'll play Charles Barkley here.
We have a 10-second delay for this.
I'll play Charles Barkley for a minute and say that I'm not a role model. I do know that sometimes when I get in a vehicle and perhaps... Occasionally, I first take off and I haven't quite finished what I was doing as far as sending, you know, texts or checking emails or things like that. I start off very slowly.
Oh, okay. Got it. So you think he's texting?
He's got two phones. He's got a phone in each hand and he's getting some last minute things arranged before he finally can take off and speed up. I don't know. That's just me. Sense.
But you would agree that 20 minute at Alameda doesn't help him at all, right?
No, it absolutely does not. Nor does the fact that he took a somewhat peculiar route getting into the property.
And going by the tree line instead of going to the driveway.
The discrepancy in steps when he got there versus when he left, and then stopping on the way out for an extended period of time. Not an extended, but about a minute or so, which is...
Well, yeah, it said that he had gone past where you normally park, right?
Mm-hmm.
And had gone up toward those outbuildings.
Yep.
Into the outbuilding. Well, yeah. And that goes to, you know, possibly that's what they were trying to open up about. Possibly that may be where things were stashed.
Right.
Nothing was ever searched at Alameda for 3 months.
Yeah. Now, do you think
I don't know if that's what the state was trying to do, but that's certainly the way it sounded to the people that were listening.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, by no means is this case over. So the question I have for y'all is, if you're defending, would you accept this timeline or distillation of information by the state, or would you have experts to challenge it?
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
They've got to, right? Or you're picking...
Is there a way to embrace it and still have a viable defense?
It almost seemed... Listening to Jim Griffin's motion for the directed verdict, it seems like there is some of it that they want to challenge, but it sounded more so like he wanted to challenge the circumstantial parts of it, where they haven't produced the murder weapon, they don't exactly know the time of death, they can't defend it.
And their first witness was the coroner on the time of death. I'm not so sure how effective that was, but that was their first effort, right, to challenge time of death.
Well, that is right, but also what I was thinking about as well was that the state said that he, you know, we have all this car data, and you know when he arrives back. I think they're also trying to poke holes in the alibi and show times when either Alec didn't remember the way things actually went down or didn't, you know, besides just the nap that supposedly he took at the beginning. Well, you know, at the end, it says that, you know, in less than 20 seconds, his car stops at the kennels. And he calls 911. And my big question was, well, is that enough time to realize what happened?
Yeah.
Check the bodies. Mm-hmm. Call 911. Mm-hmm. Is it enough time, depending on where he parked? Yeah. I think defense was trying to say it is.
Yeah. And did I understand, too, Drew, did you pick this up, that they were talking about when Maggie disconnected the power from her cell phone? That timeline seemed like it wouldn't give him enough time to nap, as I recall. It was like,
no, it wouldn't have. Not for as long as he said he did. Mm-hmm. I'd have to go back and look at my notes real quick, but it looked like Maggie didn't get there until
late.
Yeah.
Yeah, much later than I thought she would.
Once the camera's off of me in just a minute and I'm not talking, I'll go back and look and I'll come back to that on my notes. But yeah, I think I actually did today make a note of a few things that from the state's perspective, or I guess from either the state or the defense's perspective, Alec Murdoch has to answer for that. That so far we have no plausible answer for. Mm-hmm. Number one, why did he delete all his calls? Why did he delete his entire call log? What did he have to hide? Mm-hmm. Number two, where did those clothes go from that Snapchat video? What happened to that blue shirt? When and why did he change clothes? Because it doesn't show him going up to the house until sometime after 8 with Paul. And I mean, he could have done it then, but you'd think the shirt would be there. Mm-hmm. And then finally, how do you, the big one, what we could call the big lie, I guess, or the whatever you may want to use as a euphemism for that, but how do you explain the video? At 8:44 p.m., you were there. Several people have put you there. There's video with your voice in the background. And we learned today from the timeline, it takes about 5 minutes to walk from those kennels up to that house.
It's pretty rough, isn't it? Yeah.
8:44 to 8:49 when the phones lock. If you've walked away as soon as Paul's video ended, if you walked away 5 minutes later, you would still be able to hear a 300 blackout going off.
Yeah. Right.
And two shotgun blasts.
Yeah, top of live.
Yeah, it's a really tough timeline. And we were looking at some pictures of the defendant as he was listening to this timeline. Mm-hmm. It was a very uncomfortable look.
One more thing, one discrepancy that we needed, because we touched on it just a second ago with the 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. And
it was 14.
It was 17 in reality.
Okay.
It was set from the time he parked until he actually hit send on the 911 call. And I will give credit where it's due. Shout out to Mandy Powers Norrell, former state representative and candidate for lieutenant governor, I believe. But I've been follow her on Twitter. She was raising all kind of cane. I was like, no. How are they letting Phil Barber get away with saying it was 20 seconds? When in reality, if you look at Alec's call log, it was 17 seconds because he called 9-1-1-1.
Right.
And that was 17 seconds from the time he parked his car to that first 911 call, not 20, because he had to end the bad call and start a new one. So it was a little bit tighter. And so that really calls into even further into question the amount of time.
Yeah. And I should also give a shout. I don't think he would mind yours truly saying this, but the state's chief law enforcement officer after court, chief prosecutor, I should say, General Wilson, pointed the same thing out to me. Mm-hmm. I think he said 18 seconds. So the state's aware of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they'll bring it up. It's just getting tighter and tighter.
And that's where I was getting into, Charlie and Ann, speaking with you a little bit right before we went live. It was very artful the way Phil Barber for the defense kind of restated some things and stated some things in his cross-exam of Radofsky today, and was very craftily glossing over and very forcefully glossing over some other things to make it sound like, I don't know, I won't get into all the gory details of it, but he was, that can
hurt you in trial work, because jurors will then see what the truth is really in terms of the actual evidence. So it's a bit of a challenge to, even just 2 or 3 second difference can make a difference in credibility, but we'll see where that goes.
Well, Max, did you have a question from anyone?
Yeah, what are your thoughts on the text message from Paul about the drugs?
Oh, wow. Mm. No kidding.
What a topic.
Yes, that came out right at the end. Wow. And that was not by accident. That was absolute. I mean, nothing would be it for accident at this point. But, you know, the state has this text message that comes out, and the text message is basically like, Paul's reaching out to his dad, Alec. And when was that? Do you remember? It was May 6th. Okay. So May 6th, they find this text message where it's like, we got to talk. Mom's found pills, bags of pills, and I need to talk to you about this.
Not just some pills, bags, multiple bags of pills in a computer bag. There was that. The defense brought this one in, but later in May, Alex sends a text message to Maggie. I'm sorry for everything I do to you all. I love you. And then 3 days or 4 days before the murders, Alec to his co-conspirator in chief, Russell Lafitte, I need $600,000. My dad will sign. My dad, who is dying and in very poor health, he's going to sign off on it.
Wow. Did he get that money? End up getting that money?
Eventually, but I think through other means. That was in July when...
That's what he needed.
Yeah, wow. when the screws were really tightening on him to get that money back to Chris Wilson. But that was the end of the state's case. And Charlie, I want to get your thoughts on this. They proved their motive at the end. Paul was on him about the drugs.
The little detective
was on him about the drugs. He knew he needed to come up with money right away, and he was desperate for it. And so he was reaching out to his co-conspirator. There's the state's theory of motive right there. On top of that, they end with the two just heart-tugging photos, a beautiful photo of Maggie and her sister Marion, and then just a lovely family photo of Maggie and the two boys, Buster and Paul. What'd you think?
You've said it. I mean, that's obviously was purposeful, and it lays up a very powerful closing argument by, I'm assuming, since he's the chief prosecutor in this case, Assistant Attorney General Creighton Waters, because it's all right there. We'll have to see. I'm here on Friday, right? And the defense has 3 full days to kind of think through where they are. And I think you've said this earlier in another podcast. They've got ears, right? So they would have. Right. They have to know where they are. And how do you get something going here that can at least get a juror or two, or maybe all of them, you would hope, from their perspective, going their way? And I'm thinking it's going to be a combination of expert witnesses and lay witnesses pointing a path forward to how either he actually didn't do it factually or the state didn't meet its burden. Something along those lines, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, it has to be.
Maybe the two-shooter theory, I think, kind of helps. I think that, because it is, I gave my theory of how it could be done, but it's not, and also, that's physically very difficult. So I think that's where they might go.
Max, tell me, what else should we ask?
Also with that Paul text, doesn't that show like a loving son, even though your dad has his faults? You're still looking out for him?
To me, it also points to like just the family secrets. You know, I think everybody that's got a family knows pretty much that there's skeletons in the closet, right? And there's things that don't want to be outed and things that are getting outed, but they just don't know how to do it yet. And to me, that was just such a universal sort of text that son who doesn't quite know how to handle it, worried about mom, off to college for the first year or two. How do I tell dad that he's got to clean it up right now because we're all watching now? He obviously, at some level, it sounds like they've had some level of an intervention or at least a talking to, even amongst themselves. It was obviously coming to a head on so many different levels. But yeah, I totally agree. I think that, you know, one of the first things we heard from Marion Proctor, Paul Murdoch has been terribly misrepresented in the media, in the family's opinion, and they see him as a loving son to this family, which makes this even more heartbreaking, that, you know, that they really were so close to him. And you can see the pain in the Murdoch's face that are over there. Yes. John Marvin, Randy, Lynn, all of them are just suffering through this.
Is there any information how widespread the family secret might have been? We don't really know that, do we? That's just closely kept.
Charlie and I have the same question because I feel like on one hand, if it weren't more widespread, that could explain why we didn't get more. That's really kind of loaded because his character's not on trial. But if it were, and the pills and drugs didn't come in until late in the trial, but if it was really no secret, then why didn't we get more of Randy, John Marvin, his sister, all these other people who would know, who you would think would know whether or not he really had that big a drug problem.
Right.
Or it's totally on the other side. They didn't call him because they really didn't know.
Well, Chris Wilson didn't know. He said he didn't know, right?
Yeah.
He never said he knew anything about drugs.
Yeah.
Good point.
He was his best friend, and he talked to him all the time.
Yeah.
He said that.
Yeah.
He certainly did say that.
Right, right. He did say that.
And not to be so... That was not polite, the way I just phrased that. But, you know, at a certain point... There are a lot of people involved in this case who did know what was going on. And maybe it was really a scenario of a need to know basis or something like that, where it was really, really kept tight and hush hush. And it was a very small group of people, but there had to be, you feel like there had to be signs and writing on the wall, if not direct knowledge, or maybe it's a case of ignoring things to preserve peace and comfort.
A family name.
There's
a lot at stake.
You don't want to, you might think you see something out of the ordinary or amiss, but you don't call it out because you want to avoid conflict, right? And who knows? Well, there's so much to psychoanalyze there.
I know. Well, we need a behavioral therapist on board now as well, if anyone knows one out there. But I wanted to also do a shout out to, we have another podcast that we're running at the same time as this one, under the same franchise, under Unsolved South Carolina. And if you've been checking out our podcast, hopefully you're checking out this one too. This weekend would be a great opportunity to catch up, not only on the Murdochs, but we also have Finding Brittany Drexel. Do we have a little something to play for folks?
Yeah, we got that on right now. And while you're looking at this, this is what you're looking for on all the same podcast platforms that you were streaming us on, or if you're looking for us on social media, Unsolved SC POD. But it is on a separate feed for as far as the podcast feed. It's not the same feed here as that you're getting this. You're getting the Murdoch stuff on. But if you go back in our archives, you'll see a teaser episode that we did here on the Murdoch podcast feed and telling you a little bit about it. It's a documentary style produced podcast where we,
by the same team.
Yeah. It's not like what we're doing right now. It's exactly how this podcast started over a year and a half ago, where we were producing actual documentary style episodes that you might really enjoy. We hope you'll go take a look. It's a passion project for Ann and I. We've put a ton of work into it, along with Max, Sam Griswold,
Dan Michener,
so many other people who've had a role in covering the Brittany Drexel case over the last year.
So we'll have a lot of time. You've got a lot of time to catch up on a lot of news this weekend. So we've got Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdoch Murders, Money and Mystery, also under the same franchise, Unsolved South Carolina, Finding Brittany Drexel. Hope you get a chance to check out all these podcasts. Until next week, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
I hope everybody enjoys their President's Day. We will be back on Tuesday. Monday, court is dark. Defense is going to kick it off once again. On Tuesday. We'll see you then. Thank you so much.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.